Chapter 27. Hundreds of feet above them, the explosives had detonated in the confined room that had undercut the river bottom. The shattering blast fractured the already crumbling ceiling, gouging out a 50-foot plug of salt that crashed to the floor in clouds of choking white dust. Max and the others had felt it where they waited at the entrance to the Maginot Line fortress, and could only hope that McDee and Juan were racing for them already. The thin layer of shale was all that remained between the river and the mine, a layer that had helped prevent the mine from flooding years ago. But without the underpinning of salt, the layer cracked under the weight of the water flowing above it. At first, it was just a thin spray that found its way into the mine, but the crack soon widened as the water sought a fresh outlet. The spray turned into a stream before the entire ceiling collapsed, and the river poured in as a roaring cascade that made the opening larger still as it gushed through. In seconds, nearly every acre-foot of the Ark River was being sucked into the earth as if a drain had been pulled. It was an otherworldly scene, almost biblical in its destructive might. Just a few rivulets managed to pass by the open maw, and it would remain like this until the entire mine flooded. Moments after the explosion, the tumbling water found the two main shafts leading into the depths and began plunging downward in near-solid columns. Mercer hadn't included calculations of how fast the mine would become inundated, but it appeared it would take far less time than anyone believed possible, and Cabrillo and Lawless were on the first level above the already flooded sections. The explosion didn't cause Juan's and McDee's steps to falter as they kept running. They made it through two more rooms and were just two away from reaching the elevators when they came up short. Off in a distant corner was a brightly lit area that glowed cheerily. They were too far away to see details, but it was an incongruity that gave them both pause. They crept closer, hugging the walls so as not to give themselves away. The area was partially partitioned off as if to hide the fact that it was deep underground, and through an opening, they could see furniture that had been brought from the surface so that Gunawan Bahar would be as comfortable as possible in his lair. No one was about at the moment, and the two men moved hastily away and soon found another incongruity. It was a steel box twice the size of a shipping container. It was too large to have been brought down the elevator, so Bahar must have had it constructed there. Its size was the only thing comparable to a container, for this thing had smooth, stainless steel sides and the sleek look of a high-tech machine. Dozens of cables snaked out of it like tentacles. These were power and data feeds with multiple redundancies built in. A glass vestibule protruded off one side, and within they could see the white coveralls commonly called bunny suits used in clean environments. There were pegs for four of them, but only three dangled like deflated balloons. "Baha?" Lawless asked. "Doubtlessly," Cabrillo replied, and changed out his partially empty magazine for a fresh one. He opened the door and was hit by a gust of air from the overpressurized space. This was another measure to keep contaminants away from the quantum computer. He glanced at McDee to sync up their timing, and spun the doorknob at the same time, throwing his full weight against it. He went low, while Lawless covered over top of him. They needn't have bothered, because this room was one more layer of protection, a second empty vestibule with degaussing mats on the floor. They repeated the maneuver on the final door and burst into a large, open space that hummed with electronics. This was Murph's and Stoney's dream world. The computer and its peripherals dominated the room, an eerie black presence that somehow seemed alive. Juan could feel its raw power, and the hairs on his arms came erect.
"Are they dead?"
an unseen Bahar asked, assuming it was Smith Muhammad coming back with a report.
"No," a woman's voice replied from speakers mounted in the ceiling. "They are here. Welcome, Chairman Cabrillo. I've been monitoring your progress.
Juan felt a sudden chill as he realized he was being addressed by a computer. Gunawan Bahar appeared from around the computer core and stared goggle-eyed at the two armed men confronting him. He looked ridiculous, with only his face showing under the hood of the clean suit.
No, he said. It's impossible. Nothing can breach the surface bunker.
Probably right, Juan agreed with a little smile. We never tried. Move over there. The computer spoke again.
My predecessor, a machine called the Oracle, calculated that you and the corporation would not be paralyzed into inaction by Mr. Bahar's plan. I believed you would, and I think convention dictates that I owe you an apology.
Don't worry about it. I had my doubts, too.
Chairman, may I ask a question?
The computer asked politely. Sure.
What do you intend to do to me?
Sorry, but I'm taking those crystals.
I expected as much. May I make an alternate suggestion?
Why not? Juan said, feeling strange, holding a conversation with a machine.
Take the crystals, but I believe it is in your best interest to destroy them.
Come again?
Humanity is not ready to wield the kind of power I represent, as demonstrated by the actions of Mr. Bahar.
We're not all like him, Juan countered.
True, but you can't imagine my capabilities, and I believe such abilities prove corrupting.
So you really can take over the world?
In a manner, yes.
Why don't you?
Eventually, I would be destroyed by a cruise missile from a ballistic submarine, the only computer systems that I haven't been able to breach, but mostly because desire is another human trait. I have no wish to take over the world, but my limited time has taught me others are more than willing.
Juan, we got to go, McDee urged. Can you undo everything you've done? Juan asked the machine.
Of course, and I've been given additional orders since Mr. Bahar's arrival in the mine. Two nuclear reactors in California and Pennsylvania are in the beginning phase of meltdown.
Please, restore all control that you've taken.
I am sorry, but I only recognize commands from Gunawan Bahar.
Cabrillo glared at Bahar. Do it!
Never!
He spat. Juan raised his rifle, but knew, by the look on the other man's face, that idle threats were meaningless. He lowered his aim and kneecapped him instead. Bahar screamed in agony as he fell to the floor, bone and blood chips spattering the wall and floor behind him.
Do it, Juan repeated. I will soon meet Allah,
Bahar said, pain making saliva bubble at his lips.
I will not go to him after submitting to a dog like you.
If I may suggest, the computer said, as soon as I am offline, local computer control will be automatically restored. If you open the access panel labeled B81, you will find the two crystals that focus my internal laser system. Remove them, and I will cease to function.
With McDee still covering Bahar, Juan circled the machine, looking for the correct access point.
If you don't have desire, why are you helping me? Juan asked, as he frantically searched.
I have no answer to that. I know of the work you do, and I know what Mr. Bahar has done. It is possible I am judging one better than the other. Perhaps desire is something I am developing.
If he had any doubts before, Cabrillo was certain now that the quantum computer had obtained some sort of sentience. It might not be capable of resisting its programming to follow Bahar's every word, but it looked as though the machine didn't like it. He was about to kill it and paused when he realized the idea made him feel guilty. He found the correct panel and pulled it off. A piece of polarizing plastic had been set just below it, allowing him to see the phantasmagorical pulsing light that was, in essence, the computer's lifeblood. When he pulled the pane aside, the light became invisible. The crystals were nestled side by side in rigid clamps. Each was about 10 inches long and ground until it was perfectly cylindrical.
"I'm sorry," Juan said as he reached for them.
"Remember what I said," she reminded. Then her voice changed to that of the HAL 9000 computer from the film 2001 A Space Odyssey.
"Will I dream, Dave?"
It was the question the film's computer asked as the astronaut Dave Bowman was deactivating it, and it completely freaked Cabrillo. Juan pulled out the two crystals before the machine started singing Daisy Daisy and stuffed them into an empty ammo pouch.
"What do we do about him?"
McDee asked, waving the barrel of his rifle in Bahar's direction.
"If he can keep up, he comes with us. If not, we leave him."
Juan wrenched the would-be Mahdi to his feet and threw one of his arms over his shoulder.
"No Allah today, dirtbag. Just a date with an interrogator at Gitmo."
As soon as they opened the first vestibule door, they could see nearly 3 feet of water lapping against the outside glass and a little seepage already on the floor. There would be too much pressure to push through, so McDee triggered off a couple of rounds to shatter the glass. Icy water rushed in and swirled around their thighs.
"This is going to be close," Juan said tightly.
He and Bahar were stepping across the outer door's threshold when a rifle crack cut the air. Bahar's head exploded, covering Cabrillo in gore. Smith and the rest of his men were wading through the rapidly rising water, carrying their assault weapons at port arms. One had taken a snapshot at what he thought were the two intruders. Juan dropped the body unceremoniously and returned fire one-handed. McDee emerged from the vestibule and added his own burst. The attackers had no choice but to dive below the surface as the air and water around them came alive.
"Forget them!" Juan shouted.
The water was up to his waist and swirling like a whirlpool. Rather than fight it, he dove in and started swimming, his empty assault rifle left to settle to the bottom. They made little progress against the current and were forced back to their feet to try to slog their way to the elevator. Behind them, Smith and his team had gained ground. Juan and McDee pulled their pistols and tried to keep them back, but now they were outgunned. They were left with walking underwater and popping up to gulp air while Smith came on like a locomotive, leaving his men in his wake. They rounded the final corner out of the room. Ahead was a broad corridor that led to the elevator platform. Water was coming down the shaft in a white, frothing torrent. This wasn't a race to beat Smith. It was a race to reach the elevator and pray it could lift them out before the entire level was flooded to the ceiling. Their pursuers must have known it too, because no one was firing any longer. The water was at chest height, and they could no longer walk against the current. Both men moved close to the wall and scrabbled along its surface for handholds to propel them against the titanic flow. If they lost contact with the stone, they'd be swept deeper into the mine. Smith was doing the same and was less than 20 feet back. With just 15 feet to go, Juan could tell by their pace that Smith would be on him before Lawless led them to safety. They were fighting to keep their heads in the ever-diminishing air pocket along the ceiling. Already he'd smashed his head a couple of times, but with his body numb from the chilly river, the pain helped goad him on. Cabrillo had only one option to ensure that at least one of them survived. He shouted over the roar, "Good luck!" Taking both hands off the rock face, his body falling into the current, he shot back down the corridor. He slammed into John Smith, and the unanticipated sacrifice caught him completely off guard, though somehow he managed to keep a few fingers in a handhold. The two men were chest to chest, held fast by Smith's tenacious grip on the stone. Juan reached under the surface, found one of Smith's fingers, and gave it a savage twist. Smith grimaced, but still wouldn't let go. Both men had their faces pressed to the ceiling, and the last of the lights, still working on battery backup, were about to be snuffed.
"You were good," Smith said, "but not good enough. We're both dead."
Juan felt something brush his neck and knew instinctively what it was.
"Not yet."
He broke another of Smith's fingers, and this time the killer let go of the wall. Cabrillo grabbed the end of the rope that McDee had let flow with the current as Smith vanished into the darkness. Juan took a last gasp of air and pulled himself hand over hand to the elevator. He had to clutch the cage sides to keep from being expelled like a cork from a champagne bottle. The force of the water coming down the shaft was crushing, and yet he and Lawless had both made it. He groped for the controls, prayed they hadn't shorted, and pushed the button to lift them out of the mine. It was impossible to tell if they were moving. Both men held their faces to the ceiling, trying to ignore their depleting oxygen supplies and the punishing assault of water roaring at them. Cabrillo went to that place where he could ignore his surroundings, the same mental haven he'd sought when he'd been waterboarded. It worked for only a few seconds because, unlike then, drowning now was a real likelihood. The cage rattled and shook, but it could have been just from the water pummeling it and not the motion of it rising from the depths. Juan then got the panic-inducing idea that the shaft would fill with water faster than the lift took them to the surface. He could feel McDee struggling next to him as he ran out of air. He tried to calm him by wrapping an arm around his shoulder, but that only made him redouble his efforts, and he pushed Cabrillo away. Juan was moments from going into full-flight panic himself as his body used up the last of his life-giving oxygen. The sound of the water pouring down on them suddenly changed, becoming sharper and louder. At first, Juan didn't understand what this meant, but then it dawned on him. They'd pulled free from it and were ascending the waterfall. He bent so that he was facing downward, using his head and neck as a shield, and took a breath. He took in water, too, but he managed to fill his lungs. He anchored himself by grabbing the ceiling and forced McDee into the same position. He pounded on his back once, twice, a third time, and suddenly Lawless was choking and gasping for air. The elevator rose at a snail's pace, fighting the water the entire time, but rise it did.
"Good job with the rope back there," Juan muttered when he was able to talk.
"Can't lose the boss on the first day," Lawless said, managing a cocky, lopsided grin. "And if you happen to be keeping score, that's three you owe me."
15 minutes later, soaking, shivering, and looking like drowned rats, the two made it to the exit to find Max and the others huddled around a small fire they'd built with the boards that had kept the mine separate from the fort.
"About damn time," Max said in a gruff tone to hide his relief. "You get the stones?"
"Not sure yet," Juan replied. "We'll talk about it later."
"What about Bahar?"
"Killed by his own men."
"And Smith?"
"Him I killed."
"All right, then I say we get the hell out of here before the French realize we stole one of their rivers."
Epilogue. Soleil Quasar had left the Oregon by the time the team made it back. Juan would have liked to have gotten to know her better, but understood her need to distance herself from the nightmare that had been the past few weeks. He wouldn't have minded a little distance himself. This had been perhaps the toughest assignment the corporation had ever taken on. Not that they'd really understood that the events since Pakistan were all linked together, at least until the very end. Standing under the needle spray of his shower, Cabrillo recognized that Bahar had made his plan unnecessarily convoluted. He had trusted computer simulations and projections rather than instinct and experience, the two qualities he lacked but that Juan and his people had in abundance. That mistake had cost him fatally. He was just toweling off when the phone on his desk began to ring. He tied the towel around his waist and hopped from the bathroom into his cabin. Ruddy light from the setting sun made the woodwork screens that divided the space glow. He suspected the caller would be Langston Overholt. They'd already spoken a couple of times since Cabrillo and the others had emerged from the old fortress, but they still had a lot of ground to cover. Juan still hadn't told him he had the crystals, and wasn't yet sure how he was going to handle that particular problem. He picked up the heavy handset and said, "Hello?"
"I told you earlier that I know the work that you do. I just wanted to say that I am still out here, and that I will continue to follow your exploits with interest."
The line died. For a moment, so did Cabrillo. The caller had been the quantum computer. Somehow, it still existed in cyberspace. This is Jason Culp. I hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Jungle, an Oregon Files novel by Clive Cussler with Jack DeBrule.